My next guest is Josh Mance. Josh was shot and killed by a sniper on the streets of Baghdad and flatlined for 15 minutes. Medics brought him back, and he leverages his profoundly vivid near-death experience to help others overcome life's most difficult moments. This deeply inspirational work empowers us to find meaning within suffering and demonstrates the vital role we all have in creating hope for others. Next on the CJ Evolution podcast. Welcome back to the show, everybody. Patrick here. Thank you for tuning in to the CJ Evolution podcast. We continue to grow because of you, the listener and supporter. If you head over to iTunes, rate and review this show, give us that five-star rating. We sure would appreciate it. And folks, if you love coffee, and I know most of you do, you're going to love the products from Four Sigmatic. If you head over to cjevolution.com, you're going to see a link to this great company. They offer so many great products, cocos, elixirs, most notably their mushroom coffee, which I fell in love with the first time I tasted it. You're going to love it too. And best of all, you're going to get 15% off using the promo code CJEVO. So excited and proud to be partnered with Detectichem. This amazing and innovative company is protecting our brave men and women who serve the country, whether it's law enforcement, military, every day of the week. Mobile threat detection is here, folks. If you head over to cjevolution.com, you're going to see a link to Detectichem and see how they can help your organization. Without further ado, enjoy this great conversation, an inspirational conversation with Josh Mance. Such an honor and privilege to have Josh Mance on the show. Josh, are you there, sir?
Patrick, I am. Great to be here with you, brother.
Well, thank you for being here. I know you're probably very busy. I know you have a military background. We'll get into that. First of all, thank you for your service, sir. What made you join the military, Josh? I mean, I know you went to West Point, but what made you go that route?
You know, I was raised in a family of police and military folks. Mm-hmm. You know, my stepfather, who I consider my father full blown, you know, he was a career police officer and, former infantryman for a while. And then, you know, so he was one of the biggest and is still to this day, the biggest, one of the biggest influences of my life. And kind of the second influence was a gentleman named Sergeant Major Doug Vanderpool. Who is a retired Special Forces Sergeant Major and just happened to be one of my high school junior ROTC instructor. Wow. Right. So here's a guy that just retired from Special Forces and he comes into his high school and takes over a group of junior ROTC cadets. So it was a phenomenal experience and really set me up, for everything that was to come.
Now, how was your experience at, West Point?
9/11 happened my freshman year. It was an event that just completely shifted the tone of the academy. Because on that day we all realized consciously that you know we are being charged with the responsibility of leading men and women into combat. So the next 4 years it was like this very deep level of seriousness that set in over the Corps of Cadets, getting ready to go on this journey. And, you know, and that continued to get reinforced by the time I was graduating. You know, every couple of days we'd get another announcement that another recently graduated cadet was killed.
Jeez.
So it was a very just powerful time.
Because you knew you were going to go over there.
We knew, yeah. That's why I majored in Arabic. You know, it's you know, when you talk about like kind of how I was shaped and raised, there was things that were imparted upon me as a kid that I didn't even realize how powerful they would be in combat later. Paradoxical things. We kind of have this image of combat being you know, highly tactical. It's grounded in tactical expertise and overwhelming firepower. But in the counterinsurgency environment that we actually saw, Certainly we have to retain, like police officers, we have to retain that level of tactical expertise and be able to turn it on with the snap of a finger. But predominantly those engagements are led through empathy, through humility, through relationship building, through trust building. So even language, the Arabic language was indispensable, in that environment. Mm-hmm.
Now, can you talk, Josh, about the day when you were shot in Baghdad?
Yeah, we were on a patrol in northeastern Baghdad. It was actually a humanitarian patrol. And that went well, but we got diverted to another part of the sector. And long story short is we got pulled into a very complex ambush. We were engaged by an enemy sniper, and the bullet first severed the aorta of my senior non-commissioned officer, Staff Sergeant Marlon Harper. And then ricocheted into my thigh and severed my femoral. And, we lost Marlon that day. I went on to flatline for a full 15 minutes before this medical team pulled off a miracle.
Wow.
Recovered and, somehow made it back to Baghdad in about 4.5 months.
Jesus.
I wasn't supposed to be walking for 6, and I made it back to Baghdad in about 5.
Yeah.
But the emotional implications of that wouldn't emerge until a few years later. That's when they began to emerge.
Now, I'm sure you got this a lot, Josh, but I have to ask. So in that 15 minutes, when you were flatlined and they're trying to bring you back, can you describe, I'm sure you've gotten this before. Did you see anything or you know what I'm getting to?
It's a great question. Yeah. So I'm going to give you an answer that you might not expect. I did not see a white light.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't float above my body, nothing like that. So no kind of traditional out-of-body experience.
Sure.
As most people think of it. However, what I did experience, I think, was maybe even more powerful than that. And specifically, I'm talking about the precise transition point from life to death. And just to set the context here, I was dying of blood loss, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when we are bleeding out at that level, we're basically suffocating. And the body will attempt to pull the remaining blood it has into the chest cavity to protect the vital organs.
Mm-hmm.
And I over a period of about 15 minutes, I could 15, 20 minutes leading up to the point of death, I could literally feel that happening. This blood started creeping from my legs and eventually hit my chest, and where I consciously knew that that was it. Took my last breath, said my last thought, and died. But in that final moment, with that last breath, the only way that I can describe that is a feeling of absolute and complete surrender to something much greater than ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And it was through that feeling of surrender where it was like every positive, every negative, every good, every bad, all of it just vanished. And it was almost this feeling of becoming part of everything and nothing at the same time. So kind of this in many ways, some people might call that like kind of you could call that the absolute love of God, right?
Mm-hmm.
Feeling that this feeling of absolute mindfulness, right? I'm just trying to throw out a couple of different terms to guide people there based on their beliefs. But the point is that it was the point of my death was the most peaceful experience of my life. And I would really come to struggle with that in the decade that followed.
can you talk about it? Because you wrote about this, you got a book out there. Wonderful book I want to read, but it just gets amazing reviews. The Beauty of a Darker Soul, Overcoming Trauma Through the Power of Human Connection. Now talk about your road back, dealing with depression, trauma, PTSD.
Yep. So, like I said in the beginning, right, mm-hmm. I pulled off this.
It's a miracle.
Miracle of the team pulled off pulling me back to life, but like going back to Baghdad was, I was pulling staples out of my leg with a Leatherman. I was pulling documents out of my medical records. I had to lie, cheat, and steal to get back to Baghdad. It was kind of a ridiculous journey just in itself. But the kind of some of the core questions I had to ask in the years that that followed is you know, it sounds very that almost, if I stopped the story there, it would almost sound like this testament of resilience, you know, overcoming this experience. But the truth is it wasn't overcoming death. It was the challenge. It was learning to find a purpose in life again, learning to live life again. And what really emerged from that were, you know, psychological trauma is not what it seems to be in many cases. Mm-hmm. We can look at these ideas of getting shot, horrendous car accidents, rape, whatever it may be. But it's often the moral injuries that are inherent to those experiences that really form the root cause of traumatic distress afterwards. So for me, that was really a journey in discovering these sources of true sources of shame, true sources of guilt, and how that influenced every other aspect of my life without even realizing it at the time.
Mm-hmm. Can you expand a little bit more, Josh, about moral injury? Because people might be listening and they might be wondering what you mean by that.
Yeah. And thanks for asking that, because it's a really important question. This term moral wound really means that being exposed to an experience that in some way compromises our moral foundation, our worldview. And it's very important if we bring this term moral injury up to first responders, military personnel who haven't heard it before, there can be a tendency to almost take that as an accusation and make the assumption that a moral injury means that I must have committed a war crime or some blatantly obvious event that we all know is immoral. The truth is, as you guys well know, right, the law enforcement community, our military community, holds an exceptionally high moral and ethical standard. That is ingrained into all of our training. It's ingrained into our being. Those egregious cases are the far extreme, right? Very rare when they actually happen. Mm-hmm. What we're really talking about here is the moral tension associated with policing, with military service on the front lines. Mm-hmm. And, the situations that law enforcement officers encounter, can have a cumulative impact on the level of guilt and really what we believe the world should be or what the world is. For example, there's many cases where we can feel responsible. We have the perception that we were in some way responsible for causing a negative outcome. The perception that our actions were somehow unjustified. The presence of these irresolvable moral dilemmas in which every choice we make in a given situation leads to some sort of negative outcome. Mm-hmm. And then obviously the impact that has to our moral and ethical foundation. Mm-hmm. So for example, coming into how many times have you seen battered spouses, battered kids, a teenager killed in traffic accidents, a shoot, no shoot scenario, the level of risk that you have to take on, when you choose to go into a situation, quote unquote, softer,
mm-hmm.
in order to facilitate those relationships rather than, with tactical force.
Yeah.
So law enforcement professionals today have to maintain an exceptionally high level of emotional plasticity, to kind of fluctuate between those two extremes, and we're really uncovering the truth behind that and validating it for them and the clinicians who work with them.
Now, you talk to thousands, just tons of first responders everywhere, Josh. What are you hearing? What are you seeing with our brave men and women out there? What are they telling you?
With all the departments I talk to, be it law enforcement or military, mm-hmm. I see people who seem to be craving permission to discuss these topics at a deep level, and especially when it comes to these very complex emotions like guilt and shame, they're very, very difficult to articulate. They're very difficult to pin down. Mm-hmm. They kind of, you know, guilt operates like a form of cancer. At the beginning of stage one, it starts by infecting the darkest corners of our souls, often below the level of our conscious awareness. Mm-hmm. And as that infection continues to grow, we can find ourselves in stage four and in crisis, no longer knowing who we are, which certainly was a big part of my journey. Many suicidal spirals, many dangerous paths, despite all the best of intentions. So it was really uncovering what guilt actually means, what shame actually means, and giving people permission to talk about this in a responsible way, mm-hmm. you know, in a way that validates what they're actually experiencing, identifies the root cause so they can begin to overcome it, or persevere through it, I should say.
And you need to have, we were talking about this a little bit off the air, but it's so important, Josh, you know, and for the listeners out there, you need to have a command staff, you need to have leadership within the organization that believes in this, that buys off on it, because you have, I mean, leadership in any organization, military, they set the tone, right? If they're not buying on this, if they're not, they don't think it's important, it's going to trickle down.
So we're seeing, there are some departments who really embrace this and understand the importance of it, mm-hmm. right? There's a tactical importance to this. You know, if we're emotionally compromised on the job, it's certainly going to put all of us in danger. But it also makes us more effective warfighters, more effective officers. When we can learn to understand these, embrace and understand our emotional responses to situations. Mm-hmm. There are other departments who are do not embrace this at all. They maintain a very rigid mentality, a kind of a suck it up mentality. And this is one of my biggest frustrations is there's departments that get it. There's departments that don't. And I really, I have a lot of anxiety for the officers who are exposed to kind of those toxic leadership situations, where they're not able to get this out.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the big differences between DOD and law enforcement is might be kind of that DOD has a Secretary of Defense, right? Yep. When, you know, we have all these commanding generals, when they say do something, it may take some time to transform the culture, but it eventually happens. Mm-hmm. And DOD started this effort 15 years ago, very aggressively, from the Department of Defense on down. In terms of reducing stigma, setting this tone of embracing behavioral health. But, you know, law enforcement doesn't really have a Secretary of Defense. And it's, many of these efforts really come down chief to chief, department to department, and the tone that leadership sets. Mm-hmm. So I will tell you definitively that embracing these concepts, right, is number one. It's really taking care of your officers, right? And right, like as a leader, like it doesn't stop on the battlefield. It doesn't stop on the streets,
nope.
right?
Nope.
I also care about those officers long after their career is done, you know. And you yourself recently retiring, mm-hmm. It's important to think long term like that. Not to mention the true. It would take much too long to get deep into this, right? But there's a true tactical and strategic advantage to how we conduct policing and military operations that this can improve as well.
Yeah.
So
and if we're not taking care of our officers, not to say that you're going to not have disagreements and things like that. I mean, but if we're not taking care of our brave men and women who serve both military and first responders, if I'm sitting at home and I'm a young guy, Josh, and if I see how some law enforcement agencies are here, you know, some leaders in law enforcement are treating officers, why the hell am I going to go be a cop? You know, why am I going to join the military? You know, if we're not doing what we can to take care of our people, not to mention take care of them when they're in, but when they're out, take care of them.
Exactly. And really saddening. I mean, that's not even a strong enough word, but to see the level of suicide that's happening today. And unfortunately, we all know that I don't think a lot of people think of this, but really suicide is that's the tip, right? That's kind of the far extreme. of emotional trauma, psychological trauma. Think about everything that's happening before that point. The impact on the family, the impact on the spouse, the individual, the department. There's a long way to go before we reach the point of suicide. And this problem runs really deep. But I'm also here to kind of inject some hope to say that we are seeing departments that are taking action and that are turning this around. And you know, we're obviously doing our part on my end to try to contribute to this in however way we can. Yeah.
Now, talk a little bit about your shifting gears a little bit, Josh. Talk a little bit about your book. And again, we were talking again off the air about this and how it really was very therapeutic for you to write this book. Talk about that.
Yeah, you know, the Beauty of a Darker Soul was written for a general audience. Obviously, the military experience was a vehicle to do that, but it's written for anyone. It looks at psychological trauma and adversity through a very different lens, through a very grounded lens. So the first half is kind of the war story, although I don't really even call it a war story. It's really, I think if people read, especially that first half of the book, they'll see a very different form of warfare, which is much more closely related to police work, called counterinsurgency. The second half of the book really tracks the emotional downfall that happened afterwards and the subsequent breakthrough, which is kind of where it ends. But I found that book is really helpful for starting conversations, right? Like sometimes spouses, police officers, military personnel, these topics are really difficult to bring up and discuss in a productive way. And sometimes we kind of position this book in a way that people can leverage it to start having those conversations around the dinner table, if you will. Because these wounds of, you know, guilt, shame, as subversive as they are, as difficult as they are to find, they do have a weakness. And that starts with shedding light upon it. It starts with, you know, we have to be able to identify our enemy before we can overcome it. Right. This is just one, asset that can help with that.
Now, how is it? I mean, it's obviously very important, Josh, that you have the right people that you're surrounding yourself with. I mean, people that are willing to listen to, for you to lean on, or anybody out there who's suffering. Isn't that correct? You need to surround yourself with people who are going to listen. They're going to be there for you. They're going to pump you up. I know that seems simplistic on its face, but a lot of people don't have that.
It's simplistic, but it's really trusted. It's the trusted relationships in our lives that ultimately help us move through our most challenging moments. You know, certainly in my case, you know, there are points in time where, trauma is extremely isolating. And when we're consumed by shame, it can really drive these feelings of hopelessness, which if they really take hold, that can be fatal. So there's a lot of incredible things, though, that the people in our lives can do to kind of plant these healing seeds inside of our minds that set the conditions for us to persevere through those moments. So the power of human connection for me is really the only reason why I'm here today.
Sure.
You know, that being said, like I fully acknowledge that there were times when my behaviors were concerning to people in my life. I didn't think they were concerning, right? I was kind of blind to it. I was living it. But I had several occasions where people very close to me would bring that up, right? They'd kind of confront me with that truth in the right way. But that's a critical point in time. Like even in the state that I was in, it takes courage on both ends there. You know, for the individual, it takes courage for that person to make the approach and have a potentially uncomfortable conversation. But it also takes a deep level of emotional courage to remain humble, mm-hmm. and realize that sometimes the people closest to us may know more about us than we know about ourselves mm-hmm. in moments like that.
Yeah.
And I look at that as an opportunity for growth.
Yeah. And you get, like you said, I mean, it's humility. I mean, putting your ego aside and putting it out there. And I think at least in law enforcement and military, I was in the military too. It's very difficult for some people to put their ego aside and to be genuine and open with people, because that's a sign of weakness. And I view it as a sign of strength.
Right. Because ultimately what's happening, Patrick, right? If we're taking, you know, ultimately overcoming trauma, especially when we're talking about guilt and shame, it's ultimately an inward journey, mm-hmm. right? And all forms of leadership begin and end with self-leadership, right? So by cultivating our mental and emotional strength, by reflecting on those past experiences, by getting the perspective that we need to grow and transform, right? That's what ultimately can drive a long-term process of growth and transformation. Mm-hmm. So we're strengthening ourselves. If I can't understand my emotions in a given situation, then those emotions are in control of me.
Sure.
All right. So what we're doing is kind of, I think of it in a way of helping people take ownership of their process, their lives again. Mm-hmm.
Now, tell us what you're doing, great things you're doing, Josh, with Asymmetric Mind.
So we are training. We're a training company focused primarily in the behavioral health field at the moment. Mm-hmm. But we are training clinical providers, trauma therapists across the country to better work with military and law enforcement personnel. Specifically, we're training clinicians in this counterinsurgency doctrine and looking at it through the lens of moral wounds and psychological trauma. Now, counterinsurgency is inextricably linked with police work. Mm-hmm. So this content is just as applicable to police as anyone else. But the bottom line is that this, you know, going back to what we were saying at the beginning, conventional warfare or conventional policing, right? Many make the assumption that that is exclusively grounded in being a tactical expert. When on today's battlefield, the reality is that this is a very population-centric type of conflict, type of environment, that police officers need to be able to build trust with the local population, right? Just as counterinsurgents need to be able to build genuine trust with the local population. And the bottom line here is it's a very paradoxical type of conflict that flips conventional strategy on its head. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, some of the paradoxes: sometimes the best weapons do not shoot.
I like right? that. Yeah.
Sometimes the best reaction is no reaction. Mm-hmm. Right. Now that's a very hard pill to swallow. If you know, for example, if I'm being engaged by a sniper in the middle of Baghdad, the initial fear-based response or anger-based response is to fire back, right? Protect oneself, mm-hmm. you know, lay down suppressive fire, do what's tactically appropriate. But if I do that in this environment, all that would do is kill and harm a bunch of innocent civilians who had nothing to do with it.
Sure.
So that's a really basic example, but this environment is just infused with moral and ethical tension, right? And that even that situation I just described there is a form of powerlessness. It's a form of a moral wound in its own right. So we are meticulously training therapists to be able to connect with police and military culture in a way that's never been done before. And there's a lot of exciting things coming.
Yeah. Now, what do you think of modern day? Because this ties directly into leadership too, Josh. You know that.
Yep. What do you mean by modern day?
I think leadership has changed over the years. I think personally we have a leadership void.
Yeah.
In law enforcement. I can't speak for the military. I've been out of it too long. I think there's a leadership void in law enforcement now. And I don't know. I just think there's a lot of toxic leadership out there.
I agree with you. You know, what's interesting is that... You know, kind of on the One aspect of this counterinsurgency stuff is helping people recover emotionally and mentally from the environment, helping people process this. But what's really interesting about it is that if it's done right, if it's done in a genuine way, it's just as applicable to developing leaders as well, like a forward focused leadership strategy. Because today, again, in order to facilitate those trusted relationships, qualities such as empathy, humility, trust, they become indispensable in today's policing and military environments. Yet what most of us train on is the tactical stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And we're unquestionably the best in the world at that. But what we're saying is, let's cultivate this emotional plasticity. Mm-hmm. Right. Let's show how to develop empathy, how to develop trust in a very different way. Because if I can demonstrate how to build trust in a highly complex combat environment, then I can use those same qualities to build trust within my own organization. Mm-hmm. And that leading is not just this hardcore hold people to standards type of problem. Right, it requires a great deal of intellectual complexity, mm-hmm. Emotional plasticity, and in terms of being able to know when to be a little bit harder or when to be a little bit more empathetic, and the difference can really be a decisive point in the individual's life on your team.
Sure, and I think when I was still with my agency and I was part of the command staff, I didn't, as a leader in my organization, Josh, I always wanted to surround myself with people who were smarter than me.
Yeah.
If it sounds crazy. I mean, I never wanted to be the smartest guy in the room because I always wanted to learn and grow. And I had to change my mindset. I think so much of what we do in growth is directly related to mindset. So I had to, not that I couldn't be autocratic when I had to, but I always liked to be around people who I just would learn from and grow from. Isn't that a part of leadership?
A crucial part of leadership, right? I look at leadership, right? If we take an attempt to define that, right? Leadership is our ability to inspire each individual on our team and rally them towards a common objective, mm-hmm. or goal, right? In the simplest of ways, right? So you shouldn't be the expert.
Never wanted to be.
Right? You never want to be. You shouldn't be. Because if I'm the expert in everything on my team, like, that's not a very highly functional team. I want people to exceed me in skill sets and ability. Like, the leader's role isn't there. The leader's role is to be able to synthesize all of those efforts, right? And to empower people. So you, as a leader, you kind of have to know enough to be dangerous in the specific skill sets of your employees. But we certainly push ourselves to increase our knowledge and skill sets in all of those domains whenever we can. But I shouldn't be the expert, right? Mm-hmm. If I'm the expert, then the whole system really starts to get bogged down.
Yeah, and going now, looping back to what we've been talking about for the majority of the show, Josh, I would sit in one of the agencies I used to be with. I would sit in there into these meetings, and we talk about officer wellness and officer survival, and how we need to take care of our officers better than we are. And we'd have quote leaders in the organization that thought, nah, they can suck it up. You know, I've been there, done that. You know, they don't need that stuff.
Can I give you a vignette, an actual real life example?
Go ahead, brother. Go ahead.
You know, I think hopefully it's a very basic example, but it's actually really complex in terms of what we're talking about here. I do write about this in the book. I think it's in chapter 10. But bottom line is, when I was a commander in the military, I was actually in command of a very unique unit, very high-risk unit. It was called a warrior transition unit. But the bottom line is, there were so many injuries, emotional and physical, coming back from combat, that Department of Defense created this new unit to house the most severely wounded service members, right? And the mission of this organization was to allow those folks to heal, to set the conditions for their healing process. All other military responsibilities and duties were taken away, right? So what happened is that this unit became very high risk. It was kind of a hundreds of people with severe PTSD, depression, you know, psychosis, every disorder you can think of in the book. And one of the first people brought to my attention when I took command was this young soldier who refused to shave and refused to wear his uniform. And, you know, as you well know, and in police world, you know, like if you're, that's one of the most basic fundamental military standards out there. If you're refusing to play that game, you know, you're going to get kicked out. All this individual's therapists were deeply concerned about him. They couldn't make any progress. And they asked if I'd meet with him, see if I could make a dent. So the first meeting with that individual lasted 3 hours. He came in with a full beard, civilian clothes, flip-flops. Yet there's something that I saw in him. And I kind of had the awareness that, you know, this was a very difficult position to be in as a leader. Because on one hand, I had to remember my mission, which was to allow these people to heal. And I knew he was really deeply struggling, you know, with some very severe physical and emotional conditions. But on the other hand, like, we also are in a military organization. And I also, as a commander, I can't create favoritism or, you know, there's a slew of other implications for that could have been caused in the organization. Bottom line is that first meeting with him lasted 3 hours, and I never said a word about the beard. I never said a word about his uniform. And my goal with him was to build trust, right? And to find out what the real reason was here. I didn't think he was just being a, you know, deliberately disrespectful or blatant. There's something more there. Bottom line is, you know, within the next month or two, I found out, built a very deep level of trust with this individual. I found out the real reasons why he wasn't wearing his uniform. See, he used to be a top-rated non-commissioned officer in his unit. And the reason that he didn't want to wear his uniform is because he was ashamed of himself. He had gained weight because of the large number of medications he was on. His physical ability was really compromised from injuries. So he had gained so much weight that he had fallen out of standard, and he felt completely ashamed to even be wearing that uniform. Same thing with the beard. All these other implications came out too about how he was in these very toxic leadership environments, right? So the bottom line here, by leading first with empathy, not in the sense that I'm allowing myself to get run over, but in the genuine, this genuine effort of it's my responsibility as this person's leader.
Sure.
To find a way to cultivate, that inspiration in him again. Right. And the kicker to this story, Patrick, is that he was probably the quote unquote number one problem child of the unit when I first got there day one. And by the time I was changing command a year and a half later, guess who was standing in uniform, clean shaven, full uniform. Wow. And I never had to ask him. Right. And it went beyond that. He started to also influence the other members of the organization that were struggling. So he came, he went from our biggest problem child to our greatest asset, right? Because we led with empathy.
Yeah.
Right. And really started to tease that out.
It's amazing, Josh. And you could have easily, you know, done the opposite and came in there hardcore. Look, this, you know, knock your crap off, but you didn't. And I think, and again, I'm not speaking for every law enforcement agency out there, but I think we need I think we need to start leading more from the heart, use being more empathetic. And it's not a sign of weakness. It's a sign of strength, because like we've talked about before, people are not flocking to law enforcement anymore.
Right.
In this day and age where people are saying, you know what, I don't want the scrutiny. Every time you turn on the news, it seems like there's some, you know, some criticism against law enforcement. That's part of the job. I get that. But a lot of people are staying away, Josh, and we need to do better as leaders, taking care of our officers. And again, I'm not saying we live in a bubble and everything's sunshine and roses all the time. There's going to be bad days, but we need to start taking care of our officers better. And that has to start from the top.
I couldn't agree with you more. And kind of to maybe add one more thing to that is I would say that by pushing yourself as a leader, to think about this side of the coin, right? We're really talking in a lot of ways that this flexibility between what are kind of traditionally masculine characteristics of tactics, right? And kind of these harder core emotions, while also embracing these more feminine ethic characteristics of empathy and humility, right? If we live in any one of those extremes all the time, there's going to be a compromise, right, mm-hmm. within the unit. The challenge for the leader, and I think the most complex place a leader can stay, and it's a fight to stay here, is to try to force yourself to stay in the tension between those two extremes.
Yeah.
Right? It's an uncomfortable tension, but it's also the tension that's going to give you the flexibility to maneuver and express whatever quality you need to engage that individual.
Yeah. Well, Josh, as we wrap up, my friend, for all the listeners out there who might be suffering, maybe trauma, depression, what would you tell them?
You know, I tell them that, in my experience and in many people that I work with, right, there is beauty within adversity. I realize that if you're struggling with that in the moment, that's the last thing that you want to hear. But I can tell you definitively that the greatest development in my life happened in the darkest moments or coming through those dark moments. Mm-hmm. So regardless of, I understand what it feels like to feel hopeless. I understand what it feels like to be completely isolated and to feel like there's really no way to overcome this or move out of it. But that to me, that is the fight, right? That is where beauty lies within adversity. But because our experiences deepen our wisdom. They deepen our ability to empathize with others accurately. And as we persevere through it, it almost by default increases our ability to impact our organization and people in our lives that we care about most. Mm-hmm. So we are literally all in this journey together. And it's a journey that's worth it, regardless of how hard it may seem.
And Josh, if people want to reach out to you, my friend, where can they find you?
Best place is asymmetricmind.com.
Well, Josh Mance, brother, thank you so much for coming on the show. We wish you the most success in all your endeavors. Again, for the listeners out there, check out the book, The Beauty of a Darker Soul, Overcoming Trauma Through the Power of Human Connection. Where can they find that book?
That's on Amazon. So, yep, just Beauty of a Darker Soul on Amazon.
Yes, well, much success to you, my friend. Thank you so much. I would love to have you back on the show again, brother, to talk more about the great things you're doing.
Oh, anytime, man. This is a great conversation. Thank you.
All right, brother. You take care. I hope you enjoyed this great interview with Josh Mance. And if you want more information about what he is doing and his organization is doing, head over to asymmetricmind.com. And folks, stay tuned for more great guests and content on the CJ Evolution podcast.